Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Circus Podcast, episode 96.
Chianbi.
That's Hindi.
Well, welcome to 2021, everybody.
Welcome to 2021. I'm not sure if it feels much better than 2020 yet.
So far, I would say it's on par with 2020. I don't think I've seen any really great changes in the first half of January.
No, if anything, it's a bit terrifying with people storming the Cap. The same day that thousands of people stormed the Capitol, someone broke into our Brooklyn apartment building, not our apartment. But I mean, I was just like, what is 2021? Like, come on.
Yeah. You know, people were so anxious to get done with 2020. It's such an arbitrary indicator, you know, like everything is still the same as it was, you know, on December 31st in a way. And we did want to kick off the podcast just by talking about a few people who passed away in January from COVID. The first of which was a British circus owner named Jerry Cottle, who passed away at 75 from contracting coronavirus. He was most famous for his circus, the Jerry Cottle Circus, which was really successful, particularly in the 1970s and 80s in England. And he also helped present the Moscow State Circus and the Chinese State Circus in the UK. And he was just really a pinnacle in the English circus scene. I saw many people on Facebook, including Amy Saunders, aka Misbehave, write sad, nice notes about him and his passing. I do know his grandson, Whistle. So our thoughts go out to their family. It is definitely just one blow after another.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's a little depressing, all these people that have passed away this month. But another figurehead in the Broadway world is Philip Smith. And Josh and I actually were lucky enough to have a class with him. He talked at the Schubert class at Columbia. So he and Bob Wankel basically were the co-CEOs, chairman of the Schubert organization. And the Schuberts own 17 of the 41 Broadway theaters. Phil died of COVID at 89. But he had been working at the Schubert organization for almost his whole life. Like, he started as a box office manager at the Imperial Theater, but he worked under Bernie Jacobs and Gerald Schoenfeld, who are, two of the biggest names. Also, they like revitalized Broadway from it being like prostitutes and crack dens on Broadway to what it is now. And what's crazy is Phil Smith also is who changed kind of the ticket buying strategy on Broadway, because before him, you couldn't buy tickets with credit cards. It was only mail orders or at the box office. So they also he also helped bring telecharge to all the theaters, which is the ticket buying software that everyone uses now when you go buy a ticket for a Broadway show.
Certainly at the Schuberts. But yeah, I can't think of people much more influential on Broadway than he was for so long. But I think perhaps the most, for me, the saddest passing this month was of David Moss, who most people will know of David and Danya. They did an amazing Quick Change act. He passed away at the age of 57 last week because of COVID. And I performed with him a few dozen times at the Box in New York City, probably at least 20 times. And I can only say just such nice things about both David and Danya as, fellow performers and how amazing their act was. He grew up in Sarasota as a son of, circus performers and ringling and singers, and had always been sort of in the arts life. So it's just definitely taken too young and just really, it's unrelenting, this pandemic. And every time you think you're through it or that we see a ray of sunshine or, okay, here comes a vaccine, these things just can't come quick enough. So, our minds and hearts and thoughts go out to, Jerry Cottle's family, David and Danya's family, I'm sure. And of course, everybody at the Schubert organization who's feeling those impacts from.
I feel like that's like the first quick change act you showed me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think when people think quick change acts, like this act is probably the one that's in your head or the one that they created that's been knocked off plenty of times. For example, the finale of bursting a big ball of like silver confetti over Danya as she changes into a different dress with their finale trick. But they just had really amazing illusions. And just a really, really nice, guy.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, it's hard not to just feel down. But, you know, I do feel like the only way is to be positive. I tell myself that all the time because I'm not always positive, and try to find the positivity in things and acknowledge the bad, but then move forward from it and not be dwaddled down. I don't think I made up a new word.
Dwaddled.
Dwaddled.
Yeah, maybe dwaddled would be the word of 2020.
Dwaddled is a new word. 2021, beginning. But hey, you know, like, it's okay. We'll get through this together.
So quick update to our last two podcasts, but we've talked about the Save Our Stages Act. That was part of the restart bill that passed in December through Congress. There's been $15 billion, I believe it's B for billion, have been allocated towards grants for the performing arts sector, particularly venues. And I've been going back and forth with a number of different circus owners offline of whether or not they will qualify or not qualify for money. There's just two interesting things that I'll point out that seem a little bit strange to me and hard to know. So one is that you had to be in operation in 2019 to be eligible for funding for 2020 losses. So if you opened a show basically in 2020, you can't get money. So that's one interesting piece of it. Thankfully, Beyond Babel, our dance show, was open in 2019 in San Diego. So I think we'll be covered in that side of it. But the other strange part about the language is that it's unclear whether or not if you got an insurance payout, if that will count against you essentially getting help from the Save Our Stages Act, because you need to show your losses. And companies like ours, which got a insurance payout from our performance cancellation, received income, but that income we only received because performances were canceled. But
received it in 2020. Does that make a difference? Because that's for revenue for 2020.
Because you need to show how much money you lost in 2020 compared to how much money you made in 2019. Mm-hmm. They're basically comparing the 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then you're eligible for up to 45% of the amount that you would have made in 2019, essentially, or the difference. But if you had insurance like we did and you got a payout, it's still unclear whether or not that will be counted for you, counted against you. You know, as of recording this, it's Martin Luther King Day, Monday, January 18th, and the SBA still has not released guidance on any of these topics or the ability to apply to it. We think it'll happen before middle of February, probably, but it's still kind of unclear who this will help in particular. And some companies, some larger companies, nonprofits that have been getting PPP, the Payroll Protection Program, if you're on that, you can't also get a SOS grant. So some companies I know have already decided just to apply for the PPP and not go for these specialized venue grants because there's not enough information out about them yet.
So is the aim of looking at your 2019 revenue, is that to focus on maybe more established venues that had been there already for a year or two and not just opening a new? Is that like what they're maybe, is that where, why they're trying to do that?
I mean, I don't know if it's to do with newness necessarily. It's just their most practical way of measuring what your losses were this year. So if you say only made $10 in 2020 and you weren't open in 2019, you don't really have a way to say, well, I would have made $100, you know, unless you can say, well, last year I made $100 and this year I made $10.
Yeah, it does seem though that they should be checking, like, for the people that did open in 2020 and are still having carrying costs of keeping their show or their venue open to hopefully reopen. It seems crazy to me that they wouldn't also take that into consideration. Like, of all the things that you've already spent, like, it's weird that it's only based on revenue, if that makes sense.
I know this is a slight tangent on your point, but on a previous podcast, you and I were guessing about which Broadway shows that are currently on hiatus will return. I guessed Mean Girls will come back. We also found out this week that Mean Girls is going to be another COVID fatality. So that will not...
Josh was, you know, wrong.
Wrong on that prediction. But that's just an example, I would say, of somebody that opened in 2019, has proof losses against it. It's I believe it opened in 2019.
It did.
But it's another one of these examples of, is your show going to be eligible or not eligible? Right. It's because it's not really for shows, it's for venues. And yeah, a lot of shows can tag on into it, particularly if you're a circus and you have a venue as well. But still waiting for additional detail, a little frustrating.
It's also not even that much. that they're offering. I mean, 45%. It depends on
how much you made in 2019. That's the thing.
That's true.
We made a lot more money in New York with Beyond Babel because it was New York versus when we were in San Diego in 2019. So
where the average ticket price was, you know, $45.
Yeah. So our average ticket price in New York was $71, I think, $72. And average price in San Diego was 45, I think, yeah. Somewhere around 45, $40 to $45. So, you know, when we're comparing how we did in 2019 and 2020, it's not also totally accurate to say that those years are the same.
We're in different locations. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like when you are a touring company, you know, like seasonally, locationally, they're all different ticket prices that you can.
Yeah. I mean, if you're a touring company, you almost certainly don't qualify for it, because if you operate in, I think it's over 10 states, you don't qualify. There's some things, right, like if you have over 500 employees like Disney or Cirque did, or if you operate in this many states, or if there's a sexual nature to your performances, like it'll count you out for being eligible.
Sorry, Josh, your sexual performance.
Yes, our really sexual podcast, you know, is going to knock us out for potential PPP or SOS grants.
Oh my God. I mean, I'm trying to find positivity in all this crap. I don't know. I don't know what the positivity of the people passing is, that you can celebrate the lives and the impact that they had. The positivity of this Save Our Stage is that at least it's going somewhere.
Or it will.
It looked like it wasn't even going to happen. So, you know, there's a positivity. Okay, and on to another fun, fun positive topic. So, on Pieced.
Do you want to say quickly what On Pieced is?
I was about to until you cut me off. But On Pieced, the National Circus Arts Alliance, which is in Canada, they did a survey back in April 2020. And they now just did a second survey in November and December of 2020, which was basically looking for essentially three things: update data on the impact of the pandemic, know the measures put in place to compensate for the activities of the companies, artists, and self-employed workers, and identify incentives and programs that could contribute to the recovery of the circus arts sector. You know, essentially, you know, circus in especially Canada is a huge part of their economy and revenue, and seeing kind of what's happened since then is I think they're hoping that that will, you know, be like, you know, you have to help us, government, or, you know, this is the bad impact that's happening.
Right. So you think they did the survey just to use it as a chip to explain how much the industry is hit?
Well, yeah, I think so. And if there's anywhere that is a good case study of how bad it's been hit is Canada, I think, because it's concentrated, it's in one country, and it's very prevalent, and the government does help fund a lot of circuses there, versus Europe, which is, you know, a lot of little countries or smaller countries that do things all differently. The United States, we all know, doesn't really fund the circus arts, and it's a much wider spread. So I feel like they focus on Montreal and Quebec, and that's like I think a very good case study of seeing like really how bad circus is hit, especially because I think circus in Canada is like the most flourishing.
Or it was, certainly when we're talking about comparing 2019 to 2020. So what were some of the takeaways?
So before I say kind of the stats, 80% of the people who responded to the survey reside in Quebec, and 86% are Canadian citizens. 82% are performers, 34% are trainers, instructors, or coaches, 21% are directors or choreographers, and 13% are designers. So essentially, after 9 months of the pandemic, obviously, this art sector has been hit dramatically. And what the conclusion was is that circus-related income of individuals has dropped by 65%, and more than 80% of the individuals who responded have reported that they're unable to plan their professional futures and practice their craft, obviously. And 2/3 suffer from depression or anxiety. I mean, I think that's pretty to be expected. And then for organizations who responded, their total revenue decreased by 51%, and their own source revenues dropped between 78% to 84%, and that's an average loss of $963,000. And obviously, as for the number of spectators reached, it collapsed to less than 84%. Like, they lost 84% of their audience, and outside of Canada, it's 98%. It says more than 60% of organizations say they will cease operations if no additional funding is allocated to them after March 31st, 2020. So that's really bad. You know, like all of that is bad.
Yeah. I mean, I think another stat that I thought was very interesting in there, you mentioned the percentage, but the average annual income for a circus performer in 2019 was $38,000, which is already not that high. And no. It's a touch higher than what the average dancer makes. I think the average dancer makes like $33,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So that's like, what, $5,000 more? And this past year, it decreased to $13,000, which represents 65%. But to me, that's just really hitting, like, how many people can afford to train and work when your average income is like less than $40,000? And just breaking that down into like what people make per week, that's like less than $1,000 a week, a year.
Yeah.
So, I'm kind of curious as to like what the going rate for circus artists are in Canada, if that's taking into account the weeks people aren't performing. So maybe you're making more than $1,000 a week, but then you take 10 weeks off and it averages out to less. But in either case, that to me was just sort of an interesting just number that I hadn't previously been available.
The $40,000.
$38,000.
Well, I rounded it up. That's what an average circus performer makes.
In 2019.
Yeah.
You know, so it seems like if they're making a quarter of that, that's from the quarter of the year that was open. Mm-hmm. And then one other thing that they wrote in there that I thought was just also interesting to point to, and you gave the total number, but just breaking it down into things that were canceled, 64% were the touring shows and 59% were corporate events. Mm-hmm. Of course, still 56% development of new shows, 46% for rehearsals, and teaching and coaching is the lowest thing to get canceled at 43%. But of course, the touring shows and the corporate events are how people get paid, really. You know, I'm wondering what's the 40% of corporate events that were still happening.
Right.
But it's nice to have a document like this that took the time to do such an in-depth response. You can find all the information on Peace's website, onpeace.qc.ca, both in English and in French. But it's not a good look. You know, hopefully you're right in saying that, like, it's a tool to help fundraise, and maybe they're making it look a little worse because mm-hmm. they want extra money, you know, or they want to prove that this is how bad it is. I think just from us talking to people and being part of this community, it seems pretty accurate if you're asking me.
Yeah. The interesting thing about this document is they didn't do a similar one for Broadway, but, you know, Broadway also brings in like a ton of income. And it's like, you know, if the government doesn't help, like kind of with the Save Our Stages Act, it's like, you know, because people going to shows also increases hotels and restaurants and valets because people need to park their cars. And, you know, like if you drive into the city, you pay to go onto the highway.
Yeah, I don't think this On Peace thing took into account the greater impact of the industry.
I don't think it just said like basically like what their annual like annual revenues and what they, you know, have now. But I also think the interesting kind of topic also of the inability to plan for future jobs. Like that's so stressful. I mean, it's so stressful for us to be like, I don't know when we're going to reopen. Like I don't know when I'm going to give you another job. So I think like not only is it that you've canceled all your work, but then the inability to even be like forward thinking and okay, well, this is, I can make it through to this time. You know, the kind of like bleakness of when is it over? When do I get to perform again? What companies will be around when I can perform again? Where can I train again? Who's going to be able to train me because they're still in the industry? Like, I mean, it's a whole waterfall effect, which is really, I think, highlighted well in this document, but I would definitely like to see like a grander view of it all as well.
Well, speaking of things to, you know, look forward to, Lindsay and I are still casting for our circus show, which we are planning to tour around the Northeast region of the United States in the fall of 2021. So this year we're, what, 7 months away from that, 8 months away from that at this point. We've been having an open casting since the middle of December. We'll have another 2 weeks where that's open until the end of January before we start sending out responses and replies in February. All of the information is available on our website, hideawaycircus.com. We're really looking for artists who are a high level, can do your act, maybe do a good secondary act. Ideally, you can play an instrument or sing, have some dance training. The show is definitely going to combine a contemporary aesthetic in some scenes with a more traditional classical aesthetic in others. So regardless of sort of which style you feel you fit more into, it still may work for us. Check out all the info on our website. If you're interested, please apply. We do have a preference, of course, for American circus artists, just because of the pandemic conditions, not being able to get people to the U.S. But, you know, I think it's been great for us planning something for next year, you know.
Oh, and my God. It's like a little ray of sanity.
There's so many moving parts to it, which has been a bit of a challenge of like, what date do we think things can actually happen? And we're still sticking with rehearsals in August and performances in September. But it is always a little bit of a moving ball.
Yeah. And, it, you know, I definitely suffer from anxiety. And so when it's like 2/3 of these performers have it, I feel you. And the constant unknown is very difficult for me in life in general. And then, you know, if you're an anxious person, it's even harder. But at least being able to put your creative outlet into something is really like helpful.
One positive thing, if you're in New York, that could maybe cheer you up, is that Kyla Ernst Alper, who's an awesome aerialist we met a couple years ago when she was working on the Paradise Club in Times Square, has been working with City Point, which is a new essentially skyscraper in downtown Brooklyn. And she's convinced this like 13,000 square foot studio space to turn over the space to circus artists for 2 months. So now I'm seeing like on Instagram, all these artists who didn't have anywhere to train because different places had shut down, all training like essentially in our neighborhood. Yeah. And there's many, many people who were there before the pandemic were still there. You know, I saw Randy Cato doing his Cereal, saw Nina Gershi doing rope on Instagram. So it's nice to see the New York community has through all of this found a new training space. Way to go, Kyla, for, you know.
You can go see them train. You can go see them during different
times.
Behind glass, times.
I think you can stand behind glass and watch the circus performers.
And wear
performers.
A mask, obviously. And then there's a few times where it's like a quote-unquote showcase, I think is what they're calling it. But all the dates and times for when you can go watch people practice or perform are on the website.
Yeah, type in Brooklyn Studios at City Point. Circus should come up in Google. Kyla's website is, I believe, Anvers Entertainment. But it's just, that to me was like, awesome. Somebody's starting to figure some stuff out, even if it's just, you know, how do we train in the middle of January in New York City?
Well, aerialists are the hardest thing to train, you know, because at least if you're a handstand artist.
Tell that to the Wheel of Death performer.
Okay, sorry. Well, so one of the hardest things to train, but you need the height, and you can train on a lower rig, I guess. But if you don't get the ability to train in the air, like really where it should be, I think it's, you know, you lose your mojo a little. So it's really awesome that you found a way to.
Well, speaking of training spaces, you know, I think that's a perfect transition to our guest today, Aloysia Gavray, who runs Cirque School in LA, which is the premier Los Angeles circus training space. I was really excited to talk to Aloysia. For one reason is that we've had multiple guests at the end when we ask, who do you recommend? I've recommended talking to her. But she also has all these interesting points of overlap with other guests, whether that's her time in San Francisco with the Pickles or her time with Cirque. Or afterwards, you know, being in LA, she talks about working on different movies, circus movies that you've seen. Because granted, that's where the famous actors go to train. And I really, really enjoyed it. She also talks about how she made the best of COVID and how she went sort of through what you just described, that anxiety, uncertainty, and trying to figure out what is possible. And sounds like they've cracked, you know, some kind of online education model that does seem to work for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool that she's trained all these, you know, LA kind of celebs, but her real bread and butter is just being able to train anyone. And I think her kind of energy of like circus for any body is really nice, especially when you don't have the typical body of like super skinny athletic, you know, like no hips, no butt, no boobs. and you are at a space that like promotes the fact that it's like for anybody and anybody.
Anybody with anybody. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, that's really nice.
And one more thing for those of you just trying to sort of pinpoint references. Aloysia was also often the co-director and choreographer and creative partner of Chris Lashua on the various Cirque Mechanics show. So if you're a Cirque Mechanics fan, Aloysia has a lot of overlap with that company. She has her own troupe with her husband. She talks a little bit about the work they do as well at the end of the podcast. But I'd be surprised if you're a circus person and you haven't run into something Aluja's worked on, then you've been out of the loop.
Yeah, it's so fun to interview these people because everyone is kind of connected in some way. Like, I feel like everyone's connected through Gypsy Snyder in some way. And, you know, Gypsy is also a part of On Piste. So, like, she also was part of that. I mean, it's really cool. At some point, we really need to do like a timeline map of all of like, from, I think, like when Pickle Family Circus started and Big Apple and Circus Harmony and kind of all these little, and, you know, oh my gosh, what's this? Circus Flora, you know, when all of these circuses kind of started happening and Smirkus and like all the different, you know, kind of, it's like the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever.
6 degrees of Gypsy Snyder.
Yeah. I feel like that's the 6 degrees of Gypsy Snyder.
Yeah. I mean, I'm reading an amazing circus history book at the moment by a historian called John Culain. And it's making me, it finishes, I think, in the 1980s. I believe that's when it goes up to, or maybe finishes in the 1990s. It was published in 1990. Period, I believe. It's really a fantastic, fantastic history book, but it is making me think about how it would be possible to do a, you know, a summary of what's happened in the last 20, 30, 40 years and how it's connected to the things that happened before. But in any case, this is a good podcast for Circus History Buffs too. And before we let you listen to the episode,
if you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook and Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. We really, really like interacting with everyone and hearing tidbits that maybe we didn't know that you know. It really makes us feel happy and excited to keep doing podcasts. So definitely email us if you have anything you want to say, any suggestions of guests. And without further ado, here is our interview with Aloysia.
Aloysia, thank you so much for coming on our podcast and chatting with us. Where are we reaching you at the moment?
I'm currently in Los Angeles, California.
And are you a LA native? Where are you from originally?
Certainly not. That would make my San Francisco roots feel very betrayed. No, I'm originally from San Francisco, and I've been in Los Angeles for about 15 years.
So did you grow up seeing like Pickle Family and all the stuff that was happening in circus wise in San Francisco? Or like, when did you start? What was the circus you saw that came through San Francisco that inspired you first?
Yeah, you nailed it. Without a doubt. I think San Francisco is known for its Pickle Family Circus roots. And I feel very fortunate in a lot of ways to have actually grown up as a kid in San Francisco, seeing the shows every year, falling in love with all the artists. And then at the age of 8, I started doing Saturday circus with the Pickle Family Circus School and trained under Judy Finelli and Hannah Kahn and Wendy Parkman, who was my first aerial coach.
Is that in their church space? Yes. That sometimes you,
yes, yeah, absolutely. You got it. And I just did that, but I was also doing lots of, like, you know, dance classes and musical theater, but circus definitely took its root and took over.
So your parents aren't circus people, right?
They are not. Both of my parents are artists and educators. So they, which is part of, I think, if, you know, with more reflection as we get older, you start to think about what are your influences, and obviously very supportive of my circus endeavors. So there was a moment at the age of college or no college where that started to come up. But yeah, my Sundays were spent at museums, whether I liked it or not. it was a complete immersive experience, really, from the age. I don't even remember not going as a kid growing up. They really found the visual arts to be very important to them. And so they tried to share that as much as they could with their kids. And it definitely, as I am broadening out my own creativity, I definitely see those influences making a stronger resonance in my own work.
What did they teach?
My dad is a metal artist, and he was a professor at UC Berkeley for a while. And my mother is a mixed medium, again, visual artist, but she also ran a preschool in the Mission District in San Francisco called Buendia Family School, which is based on giving arts education to the ages of 3, 4, and 5.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. That's so cool.
So you just alluded to like the struggle of college or no college or college or circus. I'll put it that way. How did that play out for you?
So after doing that Saturday circus with as a little kid, I finally actually, when Master Louis came into the Bay Area, to San Francisco, and the Pickle Family Circus brought him in, and he was bent on starting a professional, whatever that meant to American kids in his views, program for youth. And I was actually, by that time, I was 14 years old, so I was considered old to be taking that. But my younger brother, Vasily, who was only 9, was the perfect age. So he really wanted my brother, but I convinced him after auditioning for him numerous times to accept me as well, as long as he got to have my younger brother. My brother only lasted 6 months and then couldn't handle it. But
I was going to say, does he still do circus?
No, he doesn't. But I stayed on and so did the whole program. One of Mr. Louis' first American student pod. And I did that for 4 years. And then after that, it was, okay, I'm 17 now. This is time that you apply for college. And I did the whole thing and got into UCLA to be dance and theater department, got a scholarship. And then that same summer or spring, the Pickle Family Circus asked if I would apply or audition to be an apprentice. So after doing all that work with Master Louis, they said, okay, the next progression is, if you want it, is to audition to be an apprentice. And I was like, oh my goodness, I didn't even think that that was an option, really. And they accepted me, very, very thrilled. And so then I wrote to UCLA and I said, I have this opportunity. What do you think? And they said, we're happy to defer your enrollment for a year.
And did you end up going?
Did you go back?
Well, I didn't. And it's so funny because I ended up touring with the Pickles for 6 years. But one of those stops was actually in Los Angeles. And I had had such a good rapport with the dance department that I had invited them to come see what I had decided to do instead for that year. And afterwards, they had a really heart-to-heart conversation with me and said, you know what? You're thriving so much in this environment. I think it'd be actually a foolish mistake for you to come to university. That will always be there for you, but you're really harnessing your dreams and your vision so in such a fulfilling way that it's hard for us to say, stop doing that and come and be a scholastic dance student instead of actually doing it live. So
was there a discipline that you were attracted to, like as a teenager that really you started trying to develop an act for? Where did your interest take you in that sense?
In circus.
Yeah, in circus.
Well, I had always loved aerial work. And Shana Carroll was also one of my first teachers. And I loved her approach of dance, using the feelings of dance improv up in the air. And that really resounded well in my soul. But Master Louis' approach is all about, it's all ground and a lot of handstands. And apparently I had the perfect alignment for handstands. My shoulders are like the ideal
shape.
Yes, mechanics. Yeah. And, you know, even checked out my parents, you know, as he did. And so he was a little bit disappointed that I wasn't as equally passionate about hand bouncing as I was about aerial. But the hand bouncing always stayed there. Obviously, Pickle Family Circus is all about ensemble. So you don't just get to do your one selected favorite. You have to do a little bit of everything. And I still do handstands to this day, right? If you're a handstand addict, you get it. You love being upside down. You love finding that balance for however long it is. And I'm very grateful for that moment, but it's always been the aerial arts that have attracted me.
He's just such a Master Louis. He's just, I hope I said that correctly.
Yes.
But there, he's just so prevalent in so many people's journeys of circus that, it's, Josh and I were talking, it's so interesting connecting all the dots between all these people and like where you guys intersect. And it's like, is it a specific Cirque show? Is it ENC? Is it San Francisco? You know, Pickle Family, there's just all these little tips and turns. And it's really, I'm jealous you grew up in San Francisco.
Right. And he is, I mean, Louis is one of those people, everlasting impression, right? So I'm also the founder of Cirque School now for the last 11 years. And his teaching and his dedication and his passion for each individual student is what has given me the confidence to even imagine sharing that with more people. And you're right. I don't know if you know the Hendersons and the,
sure.
Yeah. Okay. So they were little kids when I was 14, they were the ideal age. So they were the ones that Lu Yi was like, yes, I get all these four kids. And oh, okay, Aloysia, yeah, we'll keep training you. You're 14. But, so we were a big family. That time in San Francisco was a massive time. I think his ability to really amp up, not only the technique, but the drive and the ambition and the focus for young American youth was a very unique moment in time.
So I was just, you know, of course, before this, reading your bio, and how did you make the jump from Pickle Family to Cirque du Soleil? Because also just watching the Hoop Act, which I believe is what you did in Kidam. Mm-hmm. Again, like it's such a contemporary Cirque du Soleil staple, and Pickle is quite a different, as you sort of said, ensemble style approach. So how did that transition happen?
Well, I think, I don't know, at my time, it was kind of the goal for a lot of the people in my world to go to the next level. And also the Pickles were kind of trailing out by the time I was finishing. It was 96, 97. So what is the next thing? I had been in so many different shows with the Pickles that it was time for me to be challenged in new ways. And like many people, I auditioned and auditioned and auditioned for Cirque du Soleil numerous times. I can count them on one hand, not more than one hand, but, and finally with a lot of, little bit of push and perseverance with a nice shout out from Shayna at the time to some head people up there. They finally said, let's give her a try. So in 1998, they brought me to Montreal for a 9-month training period. And I will say that plane ride is the only time I've had to use the puke bag, but I used it.
Because you were nervous. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God. I couldn't believe that they were paying me to get on a plane and audition me and train me. Like that sort of responsibility was like, I better bring the goods. It was just a revelation at the time. I was 23 years old. It was what I thought I really wanted. And I was just afraid I was going to let myself down.
Did you know what project you were or what show you were going for at the time?
I knew it was going to be Kidam. I didn't know at the time if it was going to be Aerial Hoop Cerceau or Rope, but it was pretty much Aerial Hoop. And it was really great, actually, at that time. Many other people from the San Francisco quad of Pickle Family had also gotten into Saltam Bronco at that time. So that was, 98, I think. So they were remounting Saltam Bronco and they were getting ready to soon bring Kidam to Europe. So we were all there at the same time, which made it an incredibly comforting transition.
Is this where you met Chris Lashua?
Yes.
On Kidam?
Yes. Yes.
So Chris is a past podcast guest and I do believe was one of the people who recommended you.
I think so.
As well. But just checking as far as saying Saltam Bronco, did that also put Elsie and Serenity Smith on Saltam Bronco around the same time?
You got it.
This is what I'm saying. Everyone's connected.
Yeah. He's weird.
Nailing your history here, Josh.
Thank you. I take pride in my history abilities. But that's okay. So first of all, so crazy. What is it? So did you go into Kidam during the creation or after it was already open?
After the creation. So Kidam had already been on tour in the US for 2.5 or 3 years. And then they were getting ready to move on to Europe. And they also were realizing to have show stability and act stability that they needed to make sure that some of the ensemble acts. So the act that I was cast to be in was an act of 3 women. But very often one or maybe even 2 of those artists would be out for various reasons, which meant it became a solo and it gave the show an inconsistency that they were looking to help bridge that. So basically the idea was to eventually have 4 women and they would be on full rotation. So that meant that every show it would make sure that we would have 3 artists on stage at every time. So I was kind of part of like the next level of amping up show consistency and show health.
Just another, history question. Were you on tour in Kidam when Voki was on tour in Kidam?
No.
Voki Kalfayan is the clown?
No. No.
Just checking. Another person who was on that show. but who's also, you know, one of these Americans.
I will just say back to like friendships and mentors and all of that. There was certainly a time when I was in Montreal for those 9 months training where it got tough and it really came to light that my training was really from theatrical circus, and it wasn't necessarily from high intense athletic circus, or I didn't have a gymnastics background. And there was a moment where I might have been on the chopping block, and I had a very teary-eyed conversation with Gypsy Snyder in the head studio dressing rooms, and just poured my eyes out and said, how can the theatrical side of circus not be as merited as the athletic side? And she said, well, the game is a little bit different here, but there's no reason why you can't express your feelings to the show director. And she just soothed me and gave me the confidence to not to take anything away by the fact that I wasn't, you know, as tight or as strong as my counterparts who had a gymnastics background, without a doubt. But I really felt, and I knew talking to her would help, that she would be able to listen, but also give the right perspective and how to approach this conversation that I had with the show director. And I said, I'm really sad and heartbroken that you're thinking about releasing me after 8 months of training my little booty off. I get it that I don't have that natural gymnastics strength and alignment. But I really have a passion for performing and being on the stage, and I love this music and I love this act. And I had another teary conversation with him, and there you go. I did, you know, 5 years. So, again, how all the circles kind of come back. And Gypsy was there, getting ready to go on Salt and Bonco as well.
Yeah. Crazy.
So when you said that to the show director, what did he say? What was it that he was like? Okay. You know, like, what was it?
He didn't give me a definitive answer in that conversation. That came a few days later, but he said, I really appreciate you expressing yourselves, and I absolutely agree with you. We are looking for, like I said, again, healthy bodies to be consistent in the show, and gymnastics training can sometimes give that, more so than circus artists. And just also my training at that time, this was like, you know, the 80s and early 90s, it wasn't as, certainly isn't as fierce and athletic as it is now. I think that that's a whole nother conversation, but I think he appreciated my appreciation for what circus, what it was originally founded on, was this like sharing of the art and the performance charisma is something that should be of equal merit to the athleticism.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Do you feel like that the importance of athleticism, do you feel like Cirque brought that into circus? Or because obviously Ringling had high level, but it was also always about like the performer, the presentation of it all.
And Cirque brought in gymnasts.
And Cirque brought in, yeah, like this high level elite kind of like athlete vibe, and not took away a performance, but you know, the performers are makeup and look all similar. And do you feel like, I don't know, I just kind of was thinking about that.
I mean, that's a hard question. I'm sure it's a very delicate question, not to take any merit again out of what they've also given to all these opportunities that Cirque du Soleil casting has given to gymnasts, and gymnasts who maybe didn't have a career in the Olympics or had injuries that kept them from continuing on in their competitions. I think that that's a phenomenal opportunity that the arts have given to the athletic world. But in turn, how do we marry the love and the appreciation for both sides? I think you're right. I think that Cirque du Soleil's precision of the athletic ability is incredibly fierce. And sometimes with that level, you lose the connection or the ability to connect with the audience because you're so worried about the technical prowess.
That's a good way to say it.
Yeah.
So you mentioned you were on tour for 5 years, touring in the big top tent. Really sounds like its heyday when it was like still like cool and exclusive and like, what is this Cirque du Soleil thing? Why did you want to leave? Were you kicked out? How did it come to an end?
How kicked out?
Booted.
By the director, booted. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I just have to say, yeah, touring in the tent, and I had the European tour, so we were there for 3 months in each city.
Oh, nice.
So you know, I got to
fly in each city.
Yeah,
oh,
it was absolutely incredible. They transported our bikes for us, so we had our whole biking pod that we would, you know, go on adventures on our days off, or even just bike home to back to the tent and back and forth. It was really a romantic time. I also during that time, Cirque du Soleil asked that my group, the Kidam Aerial Hoop Cerso Trio, to represent them at the Monte Carlo International Circus Festival in 2002. So that was another real highlight. And then also having a very contemporary style of aerial artistry being seen within a much more traditional atmosphere was a different experience and a wonderful challenge back to the senses and back to the appreciation of circus. And after that, then we had another year of touring Kidam in the US. And then that had been too long for my brain to stay active doing the exact same thing. Which you've probably heard a lot, because what's beautiful about it is the amount of repetition that you can offer your body and your soul to, like, really be able to repeat something and master it. So however many thousands of shows that I did, something was starting to kind of decay in my brain and in my body. And I knew, because I was coming at this job as from an artist, from a circus performer, that felt like that was dangerous for me. And so I was looking for the next thing. Also, I was starting to make a few minor, like, technical errors that could have been catastrophic. And that just felt stupid. And that was because the brain wasn't fully engaged with what the body was doing. I was thinking about something else. And I only had 7 minutes on stage, pull it together. And yet after 5 years, I couldn't do it. So that was clear. And as I was getting ready to leave, though, some other directors from the Las Vegas division in Cirque du Soleil had asked, saying, "Hey, we're down some women in our Cerso aerial hoop act. Can you come and join us?" And I said, "Give me a week off." And then, yes. So then I did some subbing for them for over a year for the water show.
Amazing, cool.
Man. That must be quite an experience being pulled out of the water while spinning and
wow.
Doing that.
How do you know that, Josh? That's exactly
like, that's
what
like
happened.
The scene, right? Yeah. It's all that's like what they do with the hoops. You're all like
welcome
in the water.
Josh.
And it's also a water show. So saying you're in the water with your hoop on O is like not the hardest thing to guess.
They were very desperate at that time, either injuries or pregnancy. So they rushed me very quickly. So the whole like training of being underwater was a real kind of like mashup experience. And then of course I had numerous other cues in the show that I had to learn and some dance choreography. And they said, so the platform is going to drop down at this count of eight and just be ready for it. Well, you think I made it off the stage before it started to sink on those first couple of shows? I did not. Everybody is somehow they're off, but I'm still doing the dance choreo and the stage is becoming a pool.
I mean, that stage is insane. For some reason, I have never seen O, Le Rêve, which never will, and Mystère. It's like the three shows that I didn't ever see in Vegas, but I will see one day, hopefully. But so for O, so you basically started in the water and they what raised you up?
We actually started, Josh is slightly incorrect about this. We started on an upper level backstage, 75 feet above. We loaded onto the hoops and then were brought over by what, like a teleferic. So like this motorized rigging system that would bring, I think it was six of us out, down to the floor and then into the water. So we had this sort of like elevated over descension.
Did you ever have to be underwater with like these scuba divers?
No, that's probably why they rushed my transition so quickly, is that I wasn't at that risk at high level. Yeah.
So a question I had, we haven't released this podcast yet, but we talked to the current new CEO of Dragon. And we're talking about, of course, Franco Dragone came up and he's directed all these shows. And going back to Kidam, as a performer, obviously like Cirque is more abstract in their story and what's exactly going on. But as the CEO was, oh my God, what's
Francois Girard.
Thank you. My brain is so tired. He's awesome. Francois. What he was saying is, Franco has obviously like a very strong idea of what the story is and where it's going and what it means to him as a performer, especially coming in after creation. Did you get, for both shows, I guess, did you get a real sense of story and who you were in the moment and like what your part in the show was? Or was it kind of like, okay, you're doing your hoop act and this is the costume and music?
great question about Franco's relationship to the show Kidam and just our integration as new artists coming in and what information was relayed to the new cast members. And we had numerous lectures with all the new cast about the show development, the history, and the costume and the makeup design between each character. So we were definitely offered this feeling of reverence that you are coming into this environment and to understand the history of each piece and each interaction between the characters. And we, for some reason, this show took this very seriously. And when a new person came in, they got the same sort of lecture. And when that artist was going to share their role then with the next artist, they would go through and say, okay, this was what was told to me. This is the history behind it. I think Kidam did have a very avant-garde story, but it was definitely there. And really trailing this child's journey through an imaginative world of having more loving and playful parents. So each piece in its own sense kind of related to that. I would say I don't really know what the aerial hoop Sarso piece was, why we had, you know, tears kind of rolling down our eyes. It's a little bit of the culture of Cirque du Soleil and that it's able to be that broad and yet encompassing. I do think Franco has created long lasting effect on the shows that he's been a part of.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, just the combination of images, even if there isn't like a specific meaning behind them, is in its own right like a big skill, which is probably actually a good transition to the work you've done directing and choreographing. So maybe we can talk for a moment about what it was like going from like a performer mentality to having to deal with performers, which is a totally different ball game. And also like just did you always have that feeling like you wanted to direct and choreograph, or, you know, did you find it because you were like placed into it somehow?
Even when I was back in San Francisco working with the Pickle Family Circus, I helped kind of connect and motivate a little street festival it was a piece called Swimmin' Women. It was about 15 women at the Circus Center in San Francisco, and we got together for the summer and did some shows there. I don't know if I always thought that I'd be a director, but I was definitely like a connector of people. And I found like, oh, we should jam with you and you and you and you. And I think that sort of was always nourished, and then it blossomed into full direction. And also on Kidam, I would ask a few friends to stay late on stage and could we play with these ideas? And would somebody mind staying and leaving the lights on for us? And that happened a few times. And even Chris jammed with me with a couple of those. So that was just like artistic play. I don't think there, again, was ever any meaning towards it, but it certainly helped me give me the confidence to think that, oh yeah, I think I have something to share and I'm good, and a very lucid person, really feeling everybody's uncomfortableness or whatever the energy was within the ensemble creativity. So back to the full circle, Master Lu Yi knew that I had finished Cirque du Soleil, had retired. He also knew that Sam and Sandra from Vertical Tango, I don't know if you've heard about them.
Is that a Chinese Paul act?
Yes. Yes, they okay. should definitely yes, be. The they should definitely be on your radar. So we were all Pickle Family Circus people, and they were the ones who also left to go to Salt and Bonco at the same time.
Oh my gosh!
So Lu Yi knew that all three of us had finished those careers, and so he's like, "Listen, I think that you guys should direct the next Circus Center Pickle Family show. What do you think about it?" Traces had just been there with Seven Fingers, and they were looking for something else to present. So Sam and Sandra and myself talked, and I said, listen, I've also been jamming with my good friend Chris Lashua in Las Vegas, who I met in Kidam, and working with all of his mechanical devices, and we're starting to develop this material. Here's a little promo reel. See if you think it has any legs or if this is something we should approach Lu Yi in the Circus Center about. They saw it. They were on board. And then this things rumbled really quickly from there.
This is the birdhouse, birdcage.
Birdhouse factory.
Birdhouse, yes.
Ding.
Which I saw at New Victory Theater with Jesse Dryden Pat in it, that version.
I was there too.
Oh, and you.
slightly vintage version of it. Yes, exactly. So that was 2004. And again, it was Master Lu Yi who saw the nurturing need of a career from student to performer to the next level. So massive shout out of gratitude to him. And then that became Cirque Mechanics' sort of like flagship show that helped launch, I think, a lot of new successes beyond that.
So were you and Chris both in the original as performers iteration of that show?
Yes. So Birdhouse Factory had Chris, myself. It had Steve Ragatz. It had Sam and Sandra doing their vertical tango act. It had some pretty, it was all kind of like a little bit of the director's founders were also on stage. Also, Philip Rosenberg was in that show.
Whoa. Okay. He has his own company now with other hand-to-hand people and Tristan.
Barcode?
No, I've got all the names. Mason is in it.
Oh, Mason and Val?
Yeah, they're in like his latest. What's it? Say his name again. Sorry, Philip.
Philip Rosenberg.
Philip Rosenberg. There you go. It'll come to me what the name of that company
is. He was a kid. He was like 16 years old in Birdhouse Factory. Oh, wow. He was an apprentice that Louis said, please put him in the show. And so we did. And hallelujah. Yeah. So just like, lots of love all the way around. So that was a great project because there was five of us directors and we each took on a different part of the show. And it actually, as much work as it seems like it would have been, it was a perfect like venture into directing. Because you weren't doing
feels
it alone.
Feels very like Seven Fingersy, also in an approach of having like the multiple collaborators as opposed to like one chief, person.
And then those people made you accountable. You know, I thought this was going to be done by this time. Are you having problems? Should we swap? Do you want to take this act? I'll take that act. It was long nights, but I think a really great opportunity for each of us to kind of get our feet wet and see if it felt like something we could pursue individually.
How did you guys, well, it's like a two-part question. How did you guys break up the show on who was direct what? And then how did you also make sure the entire show had a cohesive vision and feel?
So it was pretty obvious who was going to take care of what. It was like just like a natural strength. And nobody said, there's no disagreement or at all. I don't remember there being. We also had my partner, Rex Camphouse, was also the musical director. And so we met back in the Pickles in 1992. He was a stage manager. So Lu Yi knew him very well as well. So he came in and he was a musical director. So he helped find composers and really gave them temp tracks. And so Rex worked with each director, Chris, Sam, Sandra, myself, to help give the vibe and the feeling. But then he made temp tracks for the composers that all had the same essence. So I would say in a way that it was almost like the music, obviously the dramaturgy of the show, both of those are really concrete braces to help keep it cohesive.
That's a very practical piece of advice too for people who are doing that. Music and dramaturgy can do so much to build the world. Mm-hmm. So I know you directed co-created, co-collaborated on a number of the Cirque Mechanics projects. But what ultimately brought you to LA? That seems just doesn't seem like the most obvious circus city. to start with.
Yeah. So just in regards to Cirque Mechanics, I've stayed a co-collaborator with Chris, basically whatever he needs. Sometimes it's co-direction, sometimes it's choreography, sometimes it's act creation. I am really grateful for that long-term relationship. It really helps stretch my brain, keeps my director muscles active when I'm not doing my own work. So incredibly collaborative and a fabulous, fulfilling friendship. Los Angeles actually happened because of the person who I mentioned, the music director, Rex Camphouse. He left San Francisco when I left to Montreal and pursued Cirque du Soleil. He left to Los Angeles to pursue commercial and film production. So when I left tour, I just came to LA to try it out. And I have to say that I lasted at first a year and I said, why am I in a city that doesn't appreciate me? My resume here doesn't mean anything. I'm going to go back to San Francisco. I remember that crying fit very, very clearly. And yet he's like, that's fine. We can go to sit back to San Francisco. And then he's like, what do you want to do? And the clarity was like, I just feel so grateful that I have this circus knowledge. This is what year is this? This is like 2007. And so circus training, circus fitness wasn't a big thing yet. And I felt like I wanted to give that opportunity to anybody with anybody. And so hence Cirque School was formed in Los Angeles to kind of bring, like, for me, the San Francisco vibe to the fast paced kind of more surface, reputation that Los Angeles has.
I feel like my first time I saw Cirque School, I'm trying to remember what it was. It was some celebrity who maybe you or another coach was coaching on TV. And it was,
See, that's what you remember. The Hollywood celebrities, not the good work.
Well, I've never had the privilege to visit you guys there in person, but that's, I think, the first time I saw like shots of the interior and, you know, the whole vibe you guys have going on. But what would you say are some like traits either towards like your teaching style or the school's like philosophy when it comes to teaching? You mentioned like anybody, as like a, that's clearly like a core concept, but yeah, what would you say are like some defining features of the school?
Again, this all comes back from me being grateful that I had the opportunity to learn circus at such a young age. And no matter if I had a career or not, it was life-changing. It was life-changing for me because as a young woman, 12, 13, 14, to find strength and identity as a strong woman, both physically, but also to be allowed to be feminine and pretty, but be strong. It gave me the confidence in my life to be who I am. It's circus. Even if I only had done it for a small amount of time, I feel like it would have stayed with me. And I felt like even though the school, it's obviously for all genders and for everyone, it came from a heart of like, I want to give anybody with anybody the opportunity to get upside down, challenge themselves. And the physical fitness part, that'll come, but it's really about building like self-confidence in ourselves that I think circus can give. And I felt like that was a unique gift. And at that time it was, obviously it's not so much anymore. It's not unique. There's so many circus schools happening, which is absolutely fabulous. It means it's true. It's catchy. It makes us feel good and alive and awake in our bodies. So the philosophy was really about offering entry-level classes. So it's very scholastically marketed. It's 101, 102, 103, and you graduate as you see fit and what your commitment level is. It goes all the way up to, you know, pre-professional training and, you know, people have gone on to numerous other big time companies. They don't need to be said. So it's really how you want to navigate. Cirque Schools really had programming. I'm saying had because our identity is a little bit lost right now during pandemic, but comprehensive, but also curated to the individual. The other side of it is that because we are in Hollywood, we are noticed and we have had some really great opportunities to work in mostly film, some TV, most notably Reese Witherspoon for preparing for the movie Water for Elephants. And also Christoph Waltz also came and trained with us. And that was a really fascinating experience because Reese reached out to us by a friend's recommendation and she set up an interview, in-person interview. She came with her assistant to Cirque School and sat me down and asked me a bunch of questions, just like you two are. And I was nervous as all hell. But I, at the end of it, I thought, you know what? I am so proud that she's actually this curious. It means that she's taking the circus arts seriously. And that's what we're always trying to fight for is take us seriously. So that was incredible. And she was like, okay, thank you very much. Very nice to meet you. I'll be in touch with you in a few days. Not kidding. 10 minutes later, we get the call. Okay, can we start tomorrow?
Oh, wow. Oh my gosh. So what was it like training such a well-known person for
you can't let them fall off the trapeze for like extra, such a
well-known well-known book, you know, going to be turned into a movie. What was that like?
I was actually never nervous. She was super like gung ho, fierce. I was surprised how little she took breaks. I was like, but we're going to do this again tomorrow. You know how as we train, we know how to pace ourselves for the kind of like the long haul. This is a 3 month long process. I curated the program for her. So I brought in other specialists to help her because she also needed to be able to do some aerial, some acrobatics, and some also just stage presence, right? How do we hold ourselves on stage as circus artists, either before we do an act or after we do an act, or when she's riding the elephant? What is the shoulder posture? What is the hand posture? Where is the profile, the neck, the nose? All of that. She wanted to know everything. She wanted to know about sewing costumes. She was like, it was really like a full-on circus 101 tutorial. She also brought her kids sometimes, which was great. So it was not pretentious at all. It was so human and so touching. And then again, we had Christoph Waltz come in, who was just, I don't know if you guys are familiar with him.
Yeah.
He's one of my movie crushes. So that was a little bit more intense. That was a little bit more intense. He's just like incredibly, his love and respect for the theater is what all of his questions came out of. So yes, here he is a film actor, but his origins from the theater and his understanding of the physicality of being an actor on stage, those are the kind of conversations that we have that were incredibly, I was just always honored that people of that stature could have this much interest in what it is that we have lived our lives around. And then the other person who was a total different treat was Rebel Wilson, training her for Pitch Perfect 2. And I mean, I don't know it was hard to ever keep a straight face. I'm so glad I got to be like in a comedy club for that was 2 months training with her. And again,
what did she do in Pitch Perfect 2? I saw the movie.
It was a very quick moment, but I tell you, she worked hard for this. We worked very hard together. She was in an aerial hammock, a loop. And she does a couple moves, then she goes for an inversion and she slides down. And when she slides down, her whole...
Oh, I do remember this. Yep, yep.
Crotch splits.
Great movie.
That was an Elizabeth Banks special. She was like, I want this. incredible again. And thinking all the ways of like, okay, this is painful for you. Okay, well, let's try doing this. Let's do this. And just like manipulating. I remember one day she's like, I'm going to wear shoes. I know I'm not supposed to wear shoes, but the fabric is hurting my instep so much. Can I wear shoes? And like, of course you can, Rebel. Not for the show, but for training. Absolutely. Those are definitely like some just like fun highlights. And again, a reminder that circus touches everyone. It's powerful and it's modality.
So back in 2007, I think you said, were you overwhelmed by the idea of starting a school? Or did you feel like, of course I can do this. I'm going to find a space. I'm going to find the funding. I'm going to figure this out.
So one of the things that also made me feel confident to teach circus to anyone and to find my voice as a circus instructor was that during my tenure with Cirque du Soleil, I actually was chosen by the physical therapy department to be Pilates certified by Cirque du Soleil so that I could take care of the cast warm-up and any sort of injury prevention exercises that some cast needed to stay on top of because it was a little bit too much for the physiotherapy department to handle entirely. And this was something, I don't know how long this system lasted, but during that time, all the Cirque du Soleil shows were very keen on using Pilates for injury prevention and basically helping them as a company make sure that people were able to fulfill their contracts because it's obviously costly to lose somebody to be out for surgery. So, and this was an incredible experience for me. I got to really like use my mind body activity to understand this great avenue of Pilates. And what happened is that while I was on tour, each city I was in, so whether that was from Barcelona to London to Copenhagen, the head office would help find a Pilates studio for me to go and learn under. So I was constantly in a new environment, learning a new approach. And that's
in different studios too.
Different studios around the world, all Europe at that time. So that's when I learned, okay, this is what I can do on the roller. This is what I can do with the Pilates spitball. This is what I can do with TheraBands. And that is, oh my God, that opened up so much for me. I was like, if people, I know it's so hard on the hands, on the trapeze or on the fabric or on the rope or standing on our hands as we start doing circus. But if I can infuse it with some Pilates props exercises, so we make it a little bit more accessible to all types of bodies, and then slowly we get there. Also, Pilates has such a health and wellness approach, and I would say circus doesn't.
Yes, well, you know, we joke that the Russian warm-up is clap, and, you know, I'm doing like neck left, neck right, and I'm ready.
Yeah, he is. He just did it.
For those who are you know, can't see it. But yeah. No, it does have an interesting history with body awareness, we could even say.
So that didn't feel, you can't just teach it like you can't teach anybody with anybody the way we have learned as circus artists. It's rugged, raw, and it's not always the most sensible if it's not going to be your career. The idea is to get these people out back into their careers the next day, whether they be, you know, animators for TV or producers or whatever it is their Hollywood job is. Their job isn't to like get injured doing a circus class. So all of that really helped me feel confident that I was creating programming that was going to find an audience. So I actually started experimenting with the program at a little Pilates studio. So they let me rig up some equipment. And so I was experimenting with different Pilates instructors, and then they became my students, and it kind of grew from there. So it was a lot of research and development for over a year and a half. And then I was like, okay, we're ready to go and sing with this. And then we got our own 6,000 square foot warehouse in Hollywood, and it just exploded almost a little too fast, which is great, but it kind of ran away from me in the sense that I didn't have as much like perspective. I was just so involved in the day to day. I wasn't looking at it as a wider view. And feeling what is the best for our coaches and what's the best for our students, and making sure that we're creating curriculum that was matching the needs of our community.
So you mentioned a bit before, we're all talking about it, but the pandemic, how did that go down for you guys in LA? What has the shutdown been like? Have you taken the approach of like, we'll put stuff on the internet, or more like, ugh, the internet, which is how we kind of feel sometimes. But how have you guys, you know, experienced the last 9 months?
So Los Angeles, California, I mean, California was kind of good at the beginning, but we've really lost track now. And Los Angeles has been closed, gyms. So everything for us has been closed since day one of closure. So we have not opened up at all. And I think the hardest part probably for every small business is not knowing when it's going to happen. Like, do we keep our space? So right now we still have our space, which is amazing, but it's a storage facility. And how long can we do that? And those sort of unknowns are just tormenting of the soul. And of course, like every small business, we ended. And what did we have? We had a big month-long circus act creation intensive coming up. And these students had trained so hard with their audition tapes to get that intensive going, and then canceled. Ugh. So deep heartbreak. I had to personally take like 2 weeks off, which I know doesn't sound like very much, but at the time it did. 2 weeks off. I don't know. Just scared, where I felt like I was seeing a lot of other schools like already pivoting so quickly. And I said, I'm not ready to pivot. I don't know how to do this. How can you be teaching circus virtually? How is that safe? How is that like, oh, so uncomfortable. So it took me a long time. It took me a month total. And then I started to go and I started to take classes. I became a student in all types of movement, from yoga and handstands and even like pull-up bar training. Just did it all to just see like, does this work? Can this work? I learned a lot, and I started to feel like, okay, I know how this can happen. And I curated a different type of coaching, because we know that coaching online, like we're having this conversation right now, how do you perform? And as a teacher, when you're in a space, you're still performing, I think, for your students in some level, but it's a deeper way online. Not everybody has that skill, though I do think it can be learned and their comfort can be gained. So I curated a very kind of unique approach to it, in the fact that I finally got to reach out to teachers that I had always wanted to bring to Cirque School, but couldn't due to their location. And some of them, honestly, just because LA traffic is so bad, they're not that far away. They might only be 10 miles, but it's 90 minutes to get to Hollywood. So screw that. So now, oh my God, I had access to like some of my favorite people that I wanted to pull in and expose to our community. So there's been lots. So now we offer 15 virtual classes a week. And we get to connect with students who had moved out of Los Angeles. We get to connect with students we've never met before, including all over the world. So it's been an absolutely incredible pivot, very fulfilling, and very fulfilling for me to be taking all these classes and to continue to be a student of my teachers. I think that that was something that I had lost when we were live because I was so busy. But being able to be a student of my own school helps give me a better outlook at what's needed. And I'm 46. I'm a retired circus performer. I do have some skills, but I'm still the age that I'm at. I'm kind of, in some ways, the ideal student.
Nice. Okay, one more thing I wanted to...
I have to jump off. Our five-month-old baby is now... I don't know if you can see.
Oh, moving around. Oh, so cute.
He's like...
So cute. Awake.
But just come back when you have him.
Yeah, well, so I'll be back.
Okay, so one question I wanted to know about is your circus dance theater company, which to me there should be a word that incorporates the combination of circus theater and dance, because I feel like also we always have to break that into pieces for other people to understand it. But so tell me a little bit about it, and you know where you guys, why it's all three of those things.
Okay, yeah. So Troupe Vertigo, Circus Dance Theater. It could almost be musical theater. It could almost fall into that category. Again, coming from the roots of Pickle Family and having it really be about the extrovert in a way, and really feeling that the theater is completely married in with the circus. It's not so much about the technical trick level, which can sometimes like leave the audience so removed. It's really about the communication of the artist with the public. And dance, circus dance theater. So I always kind of say like the tricks are there, but the tricks aren't enough. What is beyond the trick? It's obviously the intention of the transitions, and obviously dance helps us with that. And also dance in so many ways can be viewed as circus because we're using acrobatics within dance choreography. Because my first love was actually dance, it wasn't circus, and I was about to go to UCLA to be a dance major, I find it just incredibly innate in the body. I did a lot of contact improv training, and I even took some workshops out with Palabolas in my early 20s and really found that work to be deep in my soul. So if that's the root of it, then that'll never kind of go away. And the circus is just a layer of higher level trick vocabulary on top of the dance choreography.
And where does the theater aspect come into it? Because, I mean, I think I know what you mean, but theater could also mean, like you said, plays or musicals. So is there a text component, or is it mostly like using theatrical technique to do non-verbal storytelling?
So one of the first shows that we did here was the John Anson Ford Amphitheater up here in the Hollywood Hills. And that show is called Big Top for a New Generation and featured a rock and roll band, Nightmare and the Cat. So we had, very rock and roll style. We had a car on stage. It was really rough and tumble. We had a big rock and roll band going, big energy, big theater, like a light show. I wouldn't necessarily say that there was a story behind it. But that was kind of like our first foray. Better cut that one out, Josh. I'll leave that in. That show was our first performance in Los Angeles. And then from there, we actually continued a relationship with that presenter. And we did a show called Nighthawks, film noir circus. So that had a lot of dramaturgy in it. And it even had language. And that was based on readings of Raymond Chandler, based on the visuals of Edward Hopper. And that took us through a night of L.A. noir. And then we also did another show actually in San Francisco after Birdhouse Factory. I returned and did another show called High Water Radio. And that was turn of the century radio shows and California of the West. And that was, and we had language in that one as well. And we had a live band called the Tin Hat Trio, which was a local Bay Area favorite at the time. Now, and our latest show we did is Tableau, which features five women. So it's a show with only women. And there was no language in it, but so Tableau is a striking image. That's like the definition of it. And the idea behind that show is to create really a metaphor-rich show that celebrated women and giving them a universal voice. And I wanted to juxtapose the highly stylized nature of uniformity while embracing the unique capacity of each body. And that that show definitely falls into the world of dance theater or aerial dance theater.
You know, one another thing that I just wanted to pull apart a little bit that you said earlier that everybody says is, you know, circuses struggle to be recognized on a similar footing to dance or theater or opera or other other disciplines. And I'm wondering like where you sit on the spectrum of like, you know, nobody would say opera is for everyone, right? But circus, you know, even, you know, Cirque School is saying circus can be for everyone. And it has that approach also for the audience. Like that's, I think, a large part why Americans view it. Lowbrow isn't the perfect word for it, but like a lowbrow art form versus a highbrow art form like opera. And, you know, do you think circus would be benefited by being classified like that? Or where do you see circus fitting in that that hierarchy?
Like you feel like it's the bastard child of the American arts?
Well, I feel like, you know, we want it to be recognized because we see it as a source of funding. But in many ways, there's a natural elements like it being for everybody and it not being hoity-toity the way opera or ballet has that, you know, we shouldn't necessarily shy away from. But of course, there's big benefits to being, you know, recognized maybe the way they are in Europe or in Russia. So I'm just curious, you know, if you've done thinking about that and, you know, where you how you feel.
Well, I think it has a right. I think circus has a right to be anywhere and it will always be for everyone. It's funny that I'm being asked this question in a way because the other elements that we do with Troupe Vertigo is we collaborate with symphonies. So we actually bring curated circus shows to the symphonic stage where we work with different music directors and come up with themes or musical categories. And we've actually done full-length ballets of a Circus Nutcracker, a Circus Swan Lake, a Circus Cinderella. So we have been, and I've had this experience of putting our art form onto the symphonic stage. And it is, it makes me direct and conceive differently than in other locations, for sure. It makes me costume differently. It makes me conceive differently. There is a certain level of reverence when you enter these concert halls that I feel like it, you want to meet that reverence. Though, I think what's been really fun is actually adding in comedy and clowning. So we've had Lorenzo Pizzoni. You might know.
Sure. Yeah. Yep. Also a past podcast guest, Gypsy's brother, for yeah. those listening.
So he's played Drosselmeyer in our Circus Nutcracker. And when he was not available, it was Jan Dom, who you might know.
Oh, yep. Sure. We know Jan, based in Brattleboro at the moment.
Yes.
Yeah, Jan and Ari.
So
yep.
Two of those guys really change the energy in a symphonic hall, obviously. And that is great to see the audience kind of like loosen up a little bit. And also the idea is that certainly for symphony, we need to get the next generation interested in being part of this art form. And so by mixing the two art forms together, circus and classical or symphonic music, is opening a gateway to listening and hearing music differently when you have this visual image of the circus arts. So have definitely found it to be a different challenge as a circus director, but one that I very much welcome and adds balance to my life from kind of like the rock and roll or the ultra contemporary nature of Tableau to them being on stage doing a Circus Cinderella.
Yeah, it's interesting how circus seems to be like saving, I wouldn't say saving symphonies, but a lot of symphonies are looking to circus to bring people in. Like I haven't talked to the folks at Lone Star Circus, but I think there's a good amount of like Texas based mm-hmm. like circus symphony kinds of mm-hmm. Arrangements for that reason.
But
where else could you get the chance to like get that many musicians in a room for a circus act? Like never, right? Otherwise it's always to like a track or maybe like a small band.
Absolutely. And it's
these days.
And it's definitely like a negotiation. Because these concerts are planned so many months or years in advance, I spend a lot of time with each musical director really figuring out what's the best for the musicians. What pieces can they play right next to each other? Which pieces need breaks? We've also done collaborations with Broadway singers. So then there's singers as well doing like Broadway tunes. There's a lot of things to consider when you're making your own kind of insular show. You don't need to be concerned with those things. So that's a whole nother level where you're like, I don't like those two pieces of music together. They don't go for me. That doesn't match. But like, well, that's what's necessary for the other artists that you're sharing the stage with. So that sort of compromise.
And I'm sure from a director point of view, like a fun creative challenge, because like absolutely. You said, in all other contexts, you just get to pick what you want to work with.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, you know, I want to wrap up with the same three questions that we give everybody, but I feel like we could just keep talking, you know, about this for a while. But the first question is, has there been a piece of advice, either really good or really bad, that somebody has given you that stuck with you?
I feel like the best advice is really about, and I've had so many people say this to me over the years, so there's not a specific person, but find and charge up your mentors in your life. Like, you just never know what relationships are going to be those ones that help lead you to your next phase. And that even for me in my career where I am, I have three mentors who I like reach out to. We always need them. They're always of great value. I think cherish them.
Yeah, totally. I mean, mentorship is an amazing, amazing way to learn things and meet people. Second question, for people who are circus students of any age, but presumably people who are tuning in to learn about circus, is there a book, a movie, a TV show, a live show when it returns that you would recommend somebody who's just passionate about learning about circus to check out that maybe you've enjoyed?
Oh, goodness. I feel like I'm being aged because now everything is so available on so many different formats and YouTube. And when I was first learning, it was so much like self-discovery. I read a lot of improv theater books, Peter Brook's books. I learned so much about myself as a circus artist through understanding theater and presentation, not so much about straight up circus shows. I'll just tell you this, that my greatest Hollywood love was Gene Kelly. So I'm a big fan of all of his movies. And if you can just imagine that what he's doing is circus tricks, and he is an athletic dancer, hands down, but the way he communicates with his audience, his eyes towards the public, his persona, he is performing to me as if he is a circus artist.
Yeah, I mean, Gene Kelly. Like a famous special performer for a good reason. And is it the Empty Space is the Peter Brook?
Yes.
Wow. Book you're talking about?
Josh, yes.
Well, that's like theater 101. Everybody okay. gets that, you know. I mean, yeah. It's not, but that is like, it's his, that to me, I think, is if you're trying to read books about theater, that's like gotta be one of the most essential ones.
Absolutely.
Linz, come back to ask the final question.
Too cute.
This is when it's an epidemic and you have no childcare. Okay.
So sweet.
Thanks. So final question, who do you think we should have on our podcast?
Well, I mentioned before, I think Sam Payne and Sandra Foisy from Vertical Tango would be a really great catch. And I also think, I don't know if she's been mentioned, Carly Sheridan from who runs Viva Fest. And also,
she got mentioned recently, but not in this context. Yeah, that'd be great.
And also runs Social Circus in Las Vegas.
Say her name one more time, sorry.
Carly Sheridan.
All right, great. Well, see if we can make those happen. But Aloysia, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking with us. It's been a pleasure getting to know you. And I hope everybody who, many people have said you at the end as the final answer.
Oh,
so
sweet.
I hope those people, including Chris Lashua, who I'm sure has made it to the end, you know, enjoys the episode.
Excellent. Thanks for having me. Stay safe, you guys.
And that was our interview with Aloysia Gavray.
If you like our podcast, make sure to subscribe on iTunes, follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
And there's still a few more weeks left to apply to be in our new outdoor circus show for 2021. All of the casting details are on our website, hideawaycircus.com. Get your application in.
Have a good week.
Our podcast is also available on Circus Talk, the international circus community's online resource and employment tool. If you are not a member yet, register and find your spotlight with Circus Talk today.